was resumed. We still followed the gallery of lava, a real natural staircase, sloping as gently as those inclined planes which are found in place of stairs even yet in some old houses. We went on till 12:17, the exact time when we overtook Hans, who had just stopped short.
"Ah!" cried my uncle. "Then we have come to the end of the gallery."
I looked around me. We were in crossroads. Two paths lay before us, both dark and narrow. Which should we take? Here was a difficulty. However, my uncle would not allow himself to show any hesitation before me or the guide. He pointed to the eastern tunnel, and soon we were all three treading it. Besides, we might have stood hesitating forever, for there was nothing to determine the choice. We were absolutely forced to trust to chance. The slope of this fresh gallery was scarcely perceptible, and its sections very unequal. Sometimes a succession of arches would be disclosed, like the nave of a Gothic cathedral. The architect of the Middle Ages might have studied here all the forms of church architecture which start from the ogive. A mile farther, and we had to stoop our heads beneath elliptic arches in the Roman style, and massive pillars in the wall bent beneath the abutments of the arches. In other places, this arrangement gave place to low substructures, like beavers' huts, and we had to crawl along narrow tube-like passages. The heat was always bearable, but involuntary thoughts came over me of its intensity when the lava, ejected by Snar Fell, rushed along by the route which was now so quiet. I imagined the torrents of fire dashing against the angles of the gallery, and the accumulation of heated vapours in this narrow channel. "It is to be hoped," thought I, "that the old volcano may not take it into his head to play his old pranks again." These reflections I did not communicate to my uncle Liddenbrock. He would not have understood them. His one thought was to get forward. He walked, he slid, he even tumbled over with a resolution that, after all, was worth admiring. At 6 p.m., after a not very fatiguing walk, we had made 2 leagues south, but we were scarcely a quarter of a mile deeper. My uncle gave the signal to rest. We ate without talking much, and went to sleep without thinking much. Our preparations for night were very simple. A railway rug, in which we each rolled ourselves, composed our bedding. There was neither cold to fear, nor nocturnal intruders. Travellers in the heart of Africa, among the Saharas, in the Old World, or in the bosoms of forests in the New, are obliged to take turns at watching each other during the hours of sleep, but here there was absolute solitude, and complete security. Neither savages nor wild beasts were to be feared. We woke up next morning fresh and bright. The route was resumed. We followed the passage of lava as on the preceding day. It was impossible to tell the nature of the rocks. The tunnel, instead of going down, seemed gradually becoming absolutely horizontal. I thought, even, it seemed rising to the surface. This upward inclination became more evident about 10 a.m., and consequently so fatiguing that I was obliged to slacken pace.
"Come on, Axel, what's keeping you?" said the professor, impatiently.
"I must stop. I can't keep up with you," I replied.
"What? After only 3 hours walking on such an easy road?"
"Easy it may be, but most certainly very tiring."
"What? When it is all downhill?"
"All uphill, if you please."
"Uphill?" exclaimed my uncle, shrugging his shoulders.
"Undoubtedly. For the last half hour the slope has changed, and if we continue this way, we shall certainly get back to Iceland in time." The professor shook his head like a man determined not to be convinced. I tried to resume the conversation, but he would not answer me, and gave the signal to go on. I saw quite well that his silence was mere temper. However, I shouldered my load bravely, and went quickly after Hans, who was following my uncle. I was always afraid of letting them out of sight, for the idea of losing myself in the depths of this labyrinth made me shudder. Besides, though the upward route was more fatiguing, I had the comfort of thinking it was bringing us always nearer to the surface of the earth again. Each step confirmed me in this, and I rejoiced in the idea of seeing my little Gräuben once more. At noon, I noticed a change in the appearance of the walls of the tunnel. I was first aware of it by the reflection of the electric light becoming fainter, when I discovered that solid rock had displaced the lava coating. This rock was composed of sloping layers, often disposed vertically. We were among strata of the transition, or Silurian, period. "It is plain enough," I exclaimed. "There are the sedimentary deposits of the waters, these shales, limestones, and grits. We are leaving the granitic rock behind us. It is just as if Hamburg people should take the train to Hanover to go to Lübeck." I had better have kept my observations to myself, but my geological temperament got the better of my prudence, and my uncle heard my exclamation. "What's all that about?" he asked. "Look," I replied, pointing to the varied succession of grits and limestones, and the first indications of the slaty cleavage. "Well?" "We have reached the period when the first plants and first animals appeared."
"Ah, so that's what you think?
Look for yourself, and examine carefully." And I made him turn his lamp so as to throw the light on the wall. I expected some outburst, but he did not make the slightest remark and walked on. Had he understood me or not? Or was it that the amour-propre of uncle and savant was too great to allow himself to admit that he had chosen the wrong tunnel? Or had he determined to explore it to the very end? It was so evident that we had left the lava route, and that this road would never take us to the heart of Snæfell. However, I began to wonder whether, after all, I was not attaching too much importance to this change of strata. Perhaps I myself might be mistaken. Were we really going through the layers of rock above the granite base? "If I am right," I said to myself, "I ought to find some remains of primitive vegetation. I will look round and see." I had not gone 100 steps before incontestable proof met my eyes. And necessarily, for at the Silurian period, the seas contained upwards of 1,500 species of vegetables and animals. My feet, accustomed to treading on the hard lava, suddenly came in contact with dust, the debris of plants and shells. On the walls were distinct impressions of fucoids and lycopodiaceae. Professor Liddenbrock could not be deceived. I fancy he first shut his eyes and walked straight on. It was obstinacy in the extreme, and at last I could not stand it longer. I picked up a shell in a complete state of preservation, which had belonged to an animal nearly resembling a woodlouse, and I turned to my uncle and said, "Look!"
"Well," he replied calmly,
"it is the shell of a crustacean of the trilobite species, now extinct, that's all." "But does it not bring you to the conclusion that—"
"To the same conclusion as yours?"
"Yes, perfectly so. We have left the granite rock and the lava passage. It is possible I have made a mistake, but I shall not be sure of it till we have reached the very end of this gallery."
"You are quite right, uncle, and I should approve your intention, if we were not threatened with a danger which becomes each moment more imminent."
"And what is it?"
"The want of water."
"Well, we must put ourselves on rations, Axel."
Chapter 20. And this indeed we were forced to do. Our provisions would not last 3 days longer. I saw that when supper time came, and, unhappily, we had little hope of meeting with a spring in the transition system. All next day we continued our course through an interminable succession of arcades. We walked on without saying a word. The taciturnity of Hans seemed to have infected us. The path was not rising now, at least not sensibly. Sometimes even it appeared to slope. But this tendency, besides being very slight, could not reassure the professor, for the nature of the layers remained unmodified, and the transition period became more distinct. The electric light made the schists and limestone and old red sandstone sparkle magnificently. We might have thought ourselves examining some excavations in Devonshire, a county which gives its name to this series. Specimens of magnificent marbles clothed the walls, some of a grey agate, fantastically streaked with white, others of rich crimson or yellow with red patches. Then came specimens of speckled marbles, in dark colours, relieved by the light shades of the limestone. The greater part of these marbles bore the imprint of primitive animals. Since the day before, creation had made evident progress. Instead of the rudimentary trilobites, I noticed the debris of a more perfect order, amongst others of fishes, the ganoids and the sauropterygia, in which paleontologists have sought to discover the earliest forms of reptiles. The Devonian seas were peopled with a large number of animals of this species, and they deposited them by thousands in the rocks of the new formation. It became evident that we were ascending the scale of animal creation, of which man is at the top. But Professor Lidenbrock seemed not to notice it. He was expecting one of two things. Either that a vertical well would open below his feet and allow him to resume his descent, or that some obstacle would prevent him from continuing this route. But evening came, and neither hope was realized. On Friday, after a night during which I began to feel the torments of thirst, our little company again plunged into the windings of the gallery. After 10 hours walking, I noticed that the reflection of our lamps on the walls had strangely become fainter. The marble, the schist, the limestone, and the sandstone of the walls gave way to a dark, dull lining. Just then we came to a very narrow part, and I leaned my left hand against the wall. When I removed it, I saw it was quite black. I looked closer. We were in a coal mine. "A coal mine!" I exclaimed. "A mine without miners?" "Indeed, who knows that?" "I know it," said the professor curtly. "And I'm certain that this gallery through coal pits has not been bored by the hand of man. But whether it is nature's work or not is nothing to me. It is supper time. Let us sup." Hans prepared the meal. I scarcely ate anything and drank the few drops of water that fell to my share. Our guide's gourd, and that only half full, was all that remained to quench the thirst of three men. After the repast, my companions lay down on their rugs and found the remedy for all their fatigues in sleep. But I could not close my eyes and counted the hours till morning. On Saturday, at 6 a.m, we set off again. 20 minutes later, we arrived at a vast excavation. I owned then that human hands could never have dug out such a pit. The vaults would have been shored up, and certainly they must have been supported by some miracle of equilibrium. The cavern we were in was 100 feet wide and 150 feet high. It was evidently a hole, made in the coal formation by some violent subterranean commotion. The whole history of the coal period was written on these gloomy walls, and a geologist could have easily made out the different phases. The beds of coal were separated by strata of sandstone or compact clay, and appeared crushed by the upper layer. In that age of the world, which preceded the secondary period, immense types of vegetation clothed the earth, owing to the double action of a tropical heat and continued moisture. An atmosphere of vapors enveloped the earth completely, depriving it still of the sun's rays. Thence arises the conclusion that the high temperatures were not caused by this new fire. Perhaps even the orb of day was not yet prepared for his glorious mission. Climate did not yet exist, and a torrid heat overspread the entire surface of the globe, alike at the equator and the poles. From whence did it come? From its interior. In spite of the theories of Professor Lidenbrock, a fierce fire brooded then within the spheroid. Its action was felt to the last layers of the Earth's crust. The plants, deprived of the beneficent influences of the sun, yielded neither flowers nor perfumes. But the roots drew a vigorous life from the burning soil of those primeval days. There were but few trees, nothing but herbaceous plants, immense grasses, ferns, lycopods, sigillaria, asterophyllites, rare orders now, but then numbering thousands of different species. Now it is from this very period of exuberant vegetation that the coal formation dates. The crust of the globe, still in an elastic state, obeyed the movements of the liquid mass it covered. Hence arose numerous fissures and depressions. The plants, dragged down by the waters in great numbers, formed gradually considerable heaps below. Natural chemical action then ensued. The vegetable masses beneath the waters first changed into peat. Then, owing to the influence of the gases and the heat of fermentation, they underwent complete mineralization. Thus were formed those immense coal fields, which excessive consumption must exhaust, however, in less than 3 centuries, if the industrial world does not see to it. These reflections occupied my mind while I was gazing at the wealth of combustibles stored up in this portion of the earth. They will doubtless never be discovered. The working of such deep mines would involve too great sacrifices. Besides, what would be the use, when coal deposits are lying, one might say, on the surface of the globe in a great many countries? None but I saw these untouched mines, so they would remain till the last day of the world. Meantime, we were walking on, and I alone of the little company forgot the length of the way in geological contemplations. The temperature remained as it was during our passage through the lava and schists. Only my sense of smell was affected by the exceedingly strong odor of protocarburet of hydrogen. I recognized immediately the presence in this gallery of a large quantity of that dangerous fluid known among miners as fire damp, the explosion of which has often caused such frightful catastrophes. Happily, we were illumined by Ruhmkorff's apparatus. If we had unfortunately been so imprudent as to have ventured to explore the gallery with torches in our hands, a terrible explosion would have made an end of the journey and the travellers. This excursion in the mine continued till evening. My uncle could scarcely contain his impatience at this horizontal route. The darkness, quite deep, 20 steps distant, prevented the length of the gallery from being reckoned, and I began to think it was positively interminable, when at 6 o'clock a wall appeared suddenly in front of us. There was no opening right or left, above or below. We had reached the end of a blind alley.
"Well, so much the better," exclaimed my uncle. "I know at least what I'm about now. We are not on Sack Newsome's route, and must just turn and go back to where the road forks."
"Yes," said I, "if our strength holds out."
"And why shouldn't it?"
"Because tomorrow every drop of water will be gone."
"And of courage, too, it seems," said the professor, looking sternly at me.
I did not dare to reply. Chapter 21 The departure was fixed for an early hour next morning. No time was to be lost, for it would take us 5 days to reach the crossroads. I need not dwell on the sufferings of our return. My uncle bore them like a man who was angry with himself for yielding to weakness. Hans, with the resignation of his placid nature, and I, to speak the truth, complaining and despairing the whole time, I could not bear up against this stroke of ill fortune. As I had foreseen, the water came to an end the very first day of our journey back. Our only store of liquid now was gin, but this horrible drink burnt the throat, and I could not even endure the sight of it. I felt the temperature stifling. Fatigue paralyzed me. More than once I fell motionless. Then we had to come to a halt, and my uncle or the Icelander did their best to revive me. But I saw already that the former was struggling painfully against the extreme fatigue and the tortures of thirst. At last, on Tuesday the 7th of July, dragging ourselves along on our knees and hands, we arrived half-dead at the junction of the two passages. There I lay, like an inert lump, stretched full length on the lava floor. It was 10 a.m. Hans and my uncle, clinging to the wall, tried to nibble a few bits of biscuit. Long moans escaped my swollen lips. I fell into a profound stupor. After a little, my uncle came to me and, lifting me in his arms, said, in a tone of genuine pity, "Poor child." His words touched me, for I was not accustomed to tenderness from the austere professor. I seized his trembling hands in mine. He let me do it and looked at me. Tears stood in his eyes. I saw him lift the gourd slung at his side, and to my great bewilderment, he put it to my lips and said, "Drink." Had I heard him right? Was my uncle mad? I looked at him stupidly. I could not understand him. "Drink," he repeated. And lifting up his gourd, he drained the contents into my mouth. Oh, infinite boon! A gulp of water moistened my burning mouth, one only, but it sufficed to call back my ebbing life. I thanked my uncle with clasped hands. "Yes," he said, "a mouthful of water. The last, do you hear, the last? I kept it on purpose for you. 20 times, aye, 100 times, I have had to fight with my fearful longing to drink it, but no, Axel, I kept it for you."
"Oh, uncle," I murmured, and big tears started to my eyes.
"Yes, poor child, I knew when you reached these crossroads you would drop down half dead, and I kept my last few drops of water to revive you."
"Thanks! Thanks!" I cried.
Slightly as my thirst was quenched, I had somewhat recovered my strength. The muscles of my throat, which had become contracted, now relaxed, and the inflammation of my lips subsided. I could speak. "Well, come," said I. "There is only one course open to us now. Our water is done, and we must go right back." While I was speaking, my uncle avoided looking at me and hung down his head, unwilling to meet my eyes. "We must go back," I cried, "and find our way to Snæfell. May God give us strength to climb to the summit of the crater." "Go back," said my uncle, speaking to himself, it seemed, more than to me. "Yes, go back, and without losing an instant." A pretty long silence ensued. Then, in an odd tone, the professor went on to say, "Well then, Axel, those few drops of water have not restored your strength and courage?" "Courage? I see you are as downhearted as ever, and still speak despairingly." What sort of man was this I had to do with, and what projects was his bold spirit still entertaining? "What? You are unwilling? Shall I give up this expedition at the very moment when everything promises success? Never!
Then we must make up our minds to perish."
"No, Axel, no. Start off. Let Hans go with you. Leave me alone."
Leave you behind? Yes, I tell you, leave me here. I have commenced the journey, and I will complete it or never return. Go, Axel, go!
My uncle was violently excited. His voice, which had softened for an instant, sounded harsh and threatening. He was struggling with gloomy energy against impossibilities. I was unwilling to leave him at the bottom of this abyss, and yet the instinct of self-preservation urged me to fly from it. The guide watched this scene with his accustomed indifference. He understood what was going on, however. Our gestures showed him that each was trying to drag the other a different road, but Hans evidenced no interest in the question, though his own life was involved in it. He was ready to go if the signal to start was given, and ready to stay in obedience to the slightest wish of his master. What would I not have given that minute to have been able to make him understand me? My words and groans and accent would have moved his cold nature. I would have pointed out dangers which he never seemed to suspect. I would have made him fully alive to them, and together we might perhaps have succeeded in convincing the obstinate professor. Nay, if all other means failed, we might have compelled him to regain the summit of Snæfell. I went up to Hans and laid my hand on his. He did not stir. I pointed to the way out of the crater. He still remained motionless. My gasping breath showed my sufferings. The Icelander gently shook his head, and quietly pointing to my uncle, said, "Master!" "The master!" I cried. "Madman! He is not the master of your life. We must fly. We must drag him along. Do you understand?" I had grasped Hans by the arm and was trying to make him get up. I struggled with him, but my uncle interposed and said, "Be calm, Axel. You will get nothing out of that impassible servant. Listen, therefore, to what I propose." I crossed my arms and looked my uncle firm in the face. "The want of water," said he, "is the only obstacle in our path. In this tunnel to the east, composed of lavas, schists, and coal, we have not found a single drop of liquid. It is possible we may be more fortunate if we explore the one to the west." I shook my head with profound incredulity. "Hear me to the end," said the professor, in a constrained voice. "While you were lying motionless, I went to examine the conformation of the passage. It leads straight into the heart of the globe, and in a few hours we shall reach the granite foundation. There we must meet with springs in abundance. The nature of the rock favors this, and instinct agrees with logic in support of my conviction. Now, this is what I propose to you. When Columbus asked his ship's crews for 3 days longer to let him discover new countries, the men, sick and dismayed as they were, allowed the justice of his demand, and he discovered the new world. I am the Columbus of these subterranean regions, and I ask you to give me 1 day more. If I have not found water before the time expires, I swear to you, we will return to the surface of the earth." In spite of my irritation, I was moved by my uncle's words, and by the violent restraint he was putting on himself. "Very well," I said. "It shall be as you wish. And may God reward your superhuman energy. You have only a few hours to try your fortune. So let us start at once." Chapter 22. The descent commenced this time by the new gallery. Hans walked first, as usual. We had not gone 100 steps when the professor, throwing the light of his lantern on the wall, exclaimed, "Here are the primitive rocks. We are in the right track. Forward, forward!" When the earth's surface gradually cooled in the first stages of its formation, the diminution of its bulk produced disruptions, rents, contractions, and chasms. The passage itself was a fissure of this kind, through which the eruptive granite had forced a passage at some time. Its myriad windings formed an inextricable labyrinth through the primordial rock. The deeper we went, the more clearly defined became the successive layers of the primitive period. Geological science considers this primitive rock as the basis of the mineral crust, and she recognizes in it three distinct layers: the schist, the gneiss, and the mica schist, resting on the immovable rock called granite. Never before were mineralogists in such wondrously favorable circumstances for studying their science. What the boring machine, an insensible, inert instrument, could not bring to the surface, we could examine with our eyes and touch with our hands. Through the beds of schist, colored with beautiful shades of green metallic threads of copper and manganese, mixed with traces of platinum and gold, were twisted and intertwined. I could not but think what riches are hid in the depths of the earth, which covetous humanity will never appropriate. These treasures have been buried so deep by the convulsions of primeval times that neither mattock nor pickaxe will ever disinter them. To the schists succeeded the gneiss, of a stratiform structure, and remarkable for the regularity and parallelism of its laminae. Then the mica schists, disposed in great flakes, which are revealed to the eye by the sparkles of the white mica. The light of our lanterns, caught by the little facets of the rocky mass, flashed up by brilliant jets at every angle, and I could have fancied myself traveling through a hollow diamond, in which the rays crossed and mingled and shot out in a thousand brilliant coruscations. About 6 o'clock, this illumination began to lose its splendor and almost ceased. The walls assumed a crystallized but somber appearance. The mica became more closely mingled with the feldspath and quartz to form the rock par excellence, the hardest of all stones, that bears, without being crushed by it, the weight of the four systems. We were shut up in a prison of granite. It was 8 p.m., and no sign yet of water. My sufferings were terrible. My uncle still pushed forward. He would not stop, and kept listening for the murmur of some spring. But there was not a sound. However, I could not hold out long, for my legs refused to carry me. I struggled against my tortures as long as I could, for I did not want to make him stop. This would be to him the death knell of all his hopes, for the day was fast drawing to an end, and it was his last. At length my strength failed completely. I screamed out, "I'm dying! Come to me!" And then I fell flat on the ground. My uncle turned back, folded his arms, and looked at me attentively. Then I heard him mutter in a hollow tone, "This finishes it." A frightful gesture of rage met my glance, and I closed my eyes. When I opened them again, I saw my two companions lying motionless, wrapped in their rugs. Were they asleep? For my part, I could not get a moment's sleep. I was in too much suffering, aggravated, too, by the thought that there was no remedy for it. My uncle's words echoed in my ears, for in such a feeble state the idea of regaining the surface of the globe was out of the question. A league and a half of terrestrial crust lay above us. The whole weight of it seemed to lie upon my shoulders. I felt crushed, and exhausted myself in frantic efforts to turn round on my granite couch. Some hours elapsed. Deep silence reigned, the silence of a tomb. Nothing could reach us through these walls, the thinnest of which was 5 miles thick. However, in the midst of my stupor, I thought I heard a noise. It was dark in the tunnel, but looking closely, I fancied I could see the Icelander disappearing, lamp in hand. Why was he going? Was Hans really forsaking us?
My uncle was asleep. I tried to call out, but my voice could not make itself heard through my parched lips. The gloom had deepened into blackness, and the faint echo of the sound had died away. "Hans has abandoned us!" I cried. "Hans! Hans!" But these words were spoken within me. They never left my lips. However, after the first moment of fear, I was ashamed of suspecting a man who had given us no ground of suspicion. His departure could not be a flight. Instead of going up the passage, he was going down farther in it. A bad intention would have dragged him upwards, not downwards. This reasoning calmed me a little, and I came back to another train of ideas. Hans was so tranquil that only some grave motive could have induced him to give up his rest. Had he gone on a voyage of discovery? Had he heard some distant murmur break on the silent night, though I had not? Chapter 23. For a whole hour, I was imagining in my delirious brain all the reasons which might have actuated the quiet Icelander. A perfect tangle of absurd ideas got into my head. I thought I was going mad. But at last a noise of footsteps was heard in the depths of the abyss. Hans was coming up again. The faint light began to glimmer on the walls, and then shone fully at the opening of the passage. Hans appeared. He went up to my uncle, put his hand on his shoulder, and gently awoke him. My uncle sat up and asked what was the matter. "Fatten," replied the hunter. Violent pain certainly seems to make one become a polyglot, for though I did not know a single word of Danish, I instinctively understood what the guide meant. "Water! Water!" I cried, and clapped my hands, and gesticulated as if I were crazy. "Water?" repeated my uncle. "Far?" he asked, addressing the Icelander. "Nerat," replied Hans. "Where? Down below?" I understood every word. I seized the hunter's hands and grasped them in mine, but he looked at me with perfect calmness. We were soon ready, and set out along a passage that made a slope of 2 feet in the fathom. In about an hour we had gone 1,000 fathoms, and made a descent of 2,000 feet. That very moment, I heard an unusual sound of something running within the granite wall, a sort of dull roar, like distant thunder. I had been beginning to give way again to despair when we had walked half an hour, and still no spring had come in sight, but my uncle apprised me that Hans was not mistaken in his announcement, for that the noise I heard now was the roaring of a torrent. "A torrent?" I exclaimed. "There is no doubt of it. A subterranean river is flowing around us." We hastened our steps, spurred on by hope. The sound of the murmuring water refreshed me already. It increased sensibly. The torrent, which was running above us at first, was now taking its course along the left wall, roaring and leaping. I passed my hands frequently over the rock, hoping to find some traces of moisture, but in vain. Another half hour passed, and another half league. It was evident that the hunter could not have gone farther than this while he was away. Guided by an instinct peculiar to mountaineers, he felt this torrent through the rock, but certainly he had not seen the precious liquid at all, nor drank of it. It soon became evident, too, that if we went farther, we should be going away from the stream, for the rush was growing fainter. We turned back. Hans stopped at the precise spot where the torrent seemed nearest. I sat down beside the wall, the waters dashing within 2 feet of me with extreme violence, but still the granite wall between. Instead of thinking over the likeliest means of getting over this barrier, I yielded once more to despair. Hans looked at me, and I fancied I caught a smile on his lips. He rose and took the lamp. I followed him. He went to the wall, and I saw him lay his ear against the dry stone, slowly moving his place and always listening intently.
He was plainly trying to find out the exact part where the current made most noise. This point he discovered in the side wall to the left, about 3 feet from the ground. How excited I felt! I could not venture to guess what he was going to do, but I soon understood and applauded and loaded him with caresses when he lifted his pickaxe to attack the solid rock. "Saved!" I shouted. "Yes!" cried my uncle in rapture. "Hans is right! Ah, the brave fellow! We should never have hit upon that!" I quite believe it. Such an expedient, simple enough as it was, would never have entered our heads. Nothing seemed more dangerous than to give a blow with a pickaxe in this part of the earth's frame. Suppose some dislodgement should occur which would crush us. And what if this torrent should burst through the opening and engulf us? There was nothing chimerical in these dangers, but they could not hinder us. Our thirst was so intense that we would have risked being crushed or drowned and dug in the very bed of the ocean to relieve it. Hans did the work, for neither my uncle nor myself could have done it. Our impatient hands would have made the rock fly off in fragments under our hasty blows. The guide, on the contrary, was calm and collected, and gradually wore away the rock by little but continuous strokes, till he had dug an opening about 6 inches wide. I could hear the torrent getting louder, and I seemed already to feel the beneficent water touch my lips. Soon the pick had buried itself 2 feet in the granite. The operation had already lasted an hour. I waited with impatience, and my uncle wished to employ stronger measures, though I did all I could to dissuade him. He had already seized his pickaxe when suddenly there came a hissing noise, and then a jet of water spouted out violently and dashed against the opposite wall. Hans, who was almost upset by the force of the shock, gave a cry of pain, the cause of which I soon understood, and cried out in my turn when I found, on plunging my hands into the water, that it was boiling. "Water at 200 degrees!" I exclaimed.
"Well, it will cool," replied my uncle.
The passage was filled with steam, and a stream formed, which began to run away and lose itself in the subterranean windings. Soon we were able to indulge in our first draught. Oh, how delicious! What a priceless luxury this was! It mattered not what the water was or whence it had come. It was water, and though still warm, it brought back the ebbing life. I drank without stopping, without even tasting. But after my first moment's delectation, I exclaimed, "Why, it is mineral water. It tastes of iron."
"Capital for the stomach," said my uncle, "and highly mineralized. This journey is as good as going to Spa or Toplitz." "Oh, isn't it good?" "I should think so. Water obtained 2 leagues below the ground. There is an inky taste about it, but it is not disagreeable. No, it is really a famous tonic Hans has procured us. So I propose this health-giving stream shall receive his name."
"By all means," said I. And the river was called Hansbach. Forthwith. Hans was not the least proud of the honor. After he had refreshed himself moderately, he sat down in a corner, with his accustomed placidity. "Now," said I, "we must not let this water run away."
"Why not?" replied my uncle. "I suspect the spring is unfailing.
Never mind. Let us fill our gourds and the leather bottle, and then try and stop up the hole." My advice was followed. Hans made a bung of granite and tow, and did his best to drive it in, but it was not so easily done. We scalded our hands over the business, and our efforts were fruitless after all. The pressure was too great. "It is evident," I said, "that the source of this river is at a great height, to judge by the force of the jet."
"There is no doubt of it," replied my uncle.
If this column of water is 32,000 feet high, it has the weight of 1,000 atmospheres. But an idea has just struck me.
What is it?
Why should we be so bent on bunging up this hole?
Why, because here I stopped, for it was not easy to find a reason.
When our gourds are empty again, how do we know for certain that we shall be able to fill them?
Well, that's true.
Well, then let the water run. It will flow down naturally, and be both our guide and refreshment on the route.
That's a capital idea, I exclaimed. And with this river for our companion, there is no reason now why our projects should not succeed.
Ah, you are coming round to my way of thinking, my boy, said the professor, smiling. I am doing better than coming. I have come.
Not quite yet. We must have a few hours' rest. I actually forgot it was night, but the chronometer reminded me of the fact, and before long, after we had recruited our strength with food, we lay down, and were soon all three sleeping soundly.
Chapter 24 Next day we had already forgotten our past sufferings. I was amazed at first when I awoke not to feel thirsty, and asked myself what could be the reason. The stream running at my feet gave me sufficient answer. We breakfasted and drank of this excellent chalybeate water. I felt quite merry, and decided to go on. Why should not a man so thoroughly confident as my uncle succeed, when he had a zealous guide like Hans, and a determined nephew like me? Such were the grand ideas that came into my head. If anyone had proposed my going back to Snæfell, I should have refused indignantly. But, fortunately, we had only to continue our descent. "Come, let us start!" I shouted, awakening the old echoes of the globe by my enthusiastic tones. We set out again on Thursday at 8 a.m. The granite passage, with its varied windings and unexpected bends, seemed almost like a labyrinthine maze, but on the whole, the direction was uniformly southeast. My uncle consulted his compass constantly, that he might know exactly how much ground we had gone over. The gallery extended almost horizontally, not sloping more than 2 inches in a fathom at most. The stream ran murmuring softly at our feet. I compared it to some kindly genius who was guiding us underground, and I caressed with my hand the warm naiad whose songs accompanied our steps. My gay mood involuntarily took a mythological turn. As for my uncle, he kept fuming at the path for being so horizontal. He loved vertical lines, and it put him out of patience to be always going by an hypotenuse to the centre, instead of sliding along the radius, to use his own expression. But we had no choice, and so long as we were going towards the centre, however indirectly, we had no right to complain. Moreover, from time to time we came to steep slopes, down which the naiad ran rushing and roaring, and we went with her. On the whole, that day and the next, we went over a great distance horizontally, though comparatively little vertically. On Friday, July the 10th, we reckoned we were 30 leagues to the southeast of Reykjavik, and 2.5 leagues deep. We were in front of a yawning abyss, and frightful enough it looked, though my uncle clapped his hands when he reckoned its depth. "Famous!" he exclaimed. "This will take us a long way, and without any trouble, for the projections all the way down make a regular staircase." The ropes were arranged to avoid any risk of accident, and we commenced the descent. I dare not call it perilous, for I was already accustomed to that kind of exercise. This abyss was a narrow chasm in the rock called a fault, in scientific language. It had been evidently caused by the unequal cooling of the Earth's surface. If it had ever served as a passage for the eruptive matter ejected by Snæfell, I could not understand how there was no trace left of it whatever.
We were going down a sort of spiral staircase, which one might have thought had been constructed by the hand of man. We halted every quarter of an hour to take needful rest and to stretch our legs. Then we sat down on some projection, with our legs hanging down, eating and talking, and refreshing ourselves with a draught from the stream. The Hansbach, of course, made a cascade down this fault, to the loss of its volume, necessarily, but enough remained to quench our thirst, and we knew it must resume its quiet course when it reached more level ground. In its present foaming, angry state, it made me think of my uncle in some of his passions, while its calm, continuous flow hitherto reminded me of the tranquil Icelander. On the 6th and 7th of July, we were constantly following the windings of the stairs, and had attained a further depth of 2 leagues. We were altogether nearly 5 leagues below the level of the sea, but on the 8th, at noon, the fault, though still going southeast, began to get less vertical, only making an incline of 45 degrees. The road now became easier, though intensely monotonous. It could hardly be otherwise, for there was no scenery to enliven it. On Wednesday the 15th, we were 7 leagues below the earth, and 50 from Snare Fell. Though somewhat fatigued, we were in perfect health, and our medicine chest remained untouched. My uncle noted down every hour the indications of the compass, the chronometer, manometer, and the thermometer, those which he has published in the scientific account of his journey. By this means he could always ascertain our exact position. When he apprised me that we had gone 50 leagues horizontally, I could not forbear an exclamation. "What's the matter?" asked my uncle. "Nothing. I was only making a reflection." "What is it, my boy?" "Well, just this, that if your calculations are correct, we are no longer below Iceland."
"Do you think so?"
"We can make sure at once." I took my measurements with the compasses on my map, and found I was quite right. "We have passed Cape Portland," I said, "and 50 leagues southeast brings us to the open sea."
"Below mid-ocean," cried my uncle, rubbing his hands.
"Then the ocean is really above our heads?"
"Of course, Axel. That's not so wonderful. Are there not coal mines at Newcastle, extending far along under the sea?"
The professor saw nothing extraordinary in the fact, but my mind was quite excited with the idea of walking below the depths of the ocean. And yet what difference did it make, whether the plains and mountains of Iceland were over our heads, or the waves of the Atlantic? It was all one, since the solid granite overarched us. I soon got used to the thought, for the passage, whether straight or winding, fantastic alike in its slopes and in its turns, but always running southeast, was rapidly leading us towards the heart of the globe. 4 days later, on Saturday, July the 18th in the evening, we reached a sort of grotto, of considerable size. Here my uncle came to a halt and paid Hans his weekly wage, and it was agreed that the morrow should be a day of rest. Chapter 25. I awoke, consequently, on Sunday morning, without the usual impression on my mind that I must be up and off immediately. And though we were in the deepest depths, it was not disagreeable. We were quite fit for this existence of troglodytes. I scarcely thought of sun or stars or moon, or trees or houses or towns, or any of those terrestrial superfluities which are necessary to sublunary beings. We were fossils now, and thought such useless marvels absurd. The grotto was an immense hill. The faithful stream ran over the granite floor. At this distance from its source, the water was hardly lukewarm, and could be drank comfortably. After breakfast, the professor determined to devote an hour or two to the arrangement of his daily notes.
First, he said, I'm going to make calculations that I may ascertain our situation exactly. I wish to be able on my return to draw a map of our journey, a sort of vertical section of the globe, giving a profile of our expedition.
That would be a curiosity, Uncle. But would your observations be sufficiently exact?
Yes. I have carefully noted the angles and inclines. I'm certain there has been no mistake. Let us see first where we are. Take the compass and observe its direction.
I looked at the instrument, and after watching it carefully, I replied, Southeast by east.
Very good, said the professor, marking it down and making some hasty calculations.
Well then, my